Would you like to introduce our first guest?
I certainly feel very privileged, and I feel absolutely delighted to say good morning to Shane Fitzsimmons, the Commissioner for Resilience at the moment. We are going to spend the next 50-odd minutes talking about his life and what he's contributed and the journey that he's been through. And Shane, can I just say on behalf of Spotlight, good morning to you and thanks for being with us.
Not a problem at all, Jim. Good morning to you and good morning to Darren too.
We're absolutely delighted. Your story is an incredible one, and we're so pleased that you're going to tell the people of Western Sydney. You've told parts of your story over time, and during the next, 50-odd minutes, we're going to look at it in three stages. And first, we're going to start with, growing up. Your background, you grew up in Terry Hills. You grew up on a farm of adjusting horses and so on. Tell us what that was like. Growing up in that environment.
Yeah, that's right, Jim. And I remember as a kid, we used to live on properties around Duffy's Forest and Terry Hills, and I've got pretty vivid memories of all different properties. Mum and Dad never owned anything. They always rented. They always rented homes, but had a lot of friends and family contacts with horses and the like. And it's interesting. I go back to those same areas now, and the houses that we grew up in as kids and as a family, I think you'll find the stables invariably are larger than the homes that we grew up in. So the landscape has changed a lot over that time. But I was fortunate. I attended the one primary school, Terry Hills Primary School, from kindy right through to year six, and then after that I was able to go to Pittwater High School down on the. On the area there at Mona Vale, and I did all my high school there from year 7 to year 12. And as a teenager, I shuffled around a bit in different areas. Mum and Dad divorced when I was young, and over the years I spent time living with my mum, my dad, and between different suburbs and different locations. But I was able to maintain some steady presence at schooling over that period of time.
Yeah, truly an amazing story. And Shane, you are so open with what you've told our community. I want to take you back to an event that happened when you were age seven. And to share with us, you said about your mum, she is a very strong woman.
Absolutely. And
tell us about that.
She's a remarkable woman. She was a remarkable woman. She's since passed, only in recent years. But the... a remarkable woman, married young, had children young. She had me when I was 20, and my sisters came 2 years and 3 years thereafter. But things didn't work out at home. She was, the subject of domestic violence, and as a family, domestic violence was a real issue. And particularly when Dad would drink, that was a compounding factor in our lives. And I think when I was young, Mum made the very bold decision that enough was enough. She had to leave that relationship, get out of that situation, and she became a single mother in the 70s, which was a big ask back then. But she was fiercely independent. She worked ridiculously long hours and extraordinary work in male-dominated environments. And her focus throughout life, and I remember my sisters and I talking to her regularly later in life, that her whole goal was to love and care for her children and raise them to be the best people that they possibly could. And she worked very hard to do that, put a roof over our head and food on the table and so on and so forth. And yeah, it was a difficult time. There's no doubt about it. I've got memories of really unpleasant times. And as a young fellow, I was probably not the easiest to raise and manage. I was quite conflicted. I was emotionally very torn between wanting to be, I think every young fellow wants to be loved and respected and admired by their dad and aspire to be like their dad. And there was parts of that I really liked. There was parts that I didn't. And then I flicked between one home and another home, and I remember quite vividly on one particular night, an event got very serious and violent, and the police were called, which wasn't unusual, but the police were called on this particular occasion, and things have changed enormously, thank goodness. But I remember my sisters and I being lined up in the front yard outside the front porch of one of our homes, and it was late at night, and we were asked, we had to make a decision on the spot about who we wanted to live with, because they couldn't work out where we were best to live. And I remember in that moment, I decided I wanted to live with my dad, and my middle sister said no, she wanted to go with mum, and then my baby sister said she wanted to go with her older brother, with me. And that was just heartbreaking for everybody involved, and we reflect on that a little bit now, but I think it was less than 24 hours later my baby sister went back with mum. And yeah, so there was different ways of doing things back then, and thank goodness we've all learnt. And I think no matter who you are, those early years of life, good, bad, indifferent, the positive moments, the negative moments, I think they ultimately help shape you and drive you as you go forward in life.
Shane, can I just thank you on behalf of Spotlight for being so open and transparent and sharing with us those really, you know, moments in your life that has really, in many ways, made you who you are today. And later I'm going to talk about three people, you know, Jeff Keaton, Andrew O'Dwyer, and Samuel McPaul. Mm-hmm. And I think the love you have for people, and I want this to be known publicly from me, and the care you have came from that growing up. And that was important for me to ask that, and more important, the honesty and the vulnerability that you've been able to share with our listeners. I can't thank you enough for doing that.
Let's move, no problem at all.
Well, you're an amazing person, let me tell you, in so many ways, and Darren will be talking to you about a whole range of things. You grow up, you do the skill certificate, you start to grow as a person through all that environment, and you, like your dad, want to join the Volunteer Fire Brigade. Talk us through that and why you went at such a young age, when lots of kids were playing football and surfing and doing all that. That was your environment, and yet you made a conscious decision to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jim, I remember, look, growing up, it was a pretty simple life. A working class family, learning to entertain yourself, you know, locally was really important. But as I became a teen, I had very vivid memories of about 10-year-old. There was a really big fire season on the northern beaches back in 1979. And I remember as a little fella seeing Dad come home after those fires, and he was away for days, and communications isn't like it was today. But I remember very vividly coming home, we covered in ash and soot and all that sort of stuff. And I had this real sense of pride. I was quite concerned. I remember as a little fella being frightened about where Dad was, because you just knew the fires were going on, but the reporting and the ability to communicate were landlines at best, you know. So you were literally in this void for days, and they were away firefighting for days. But then as I grew up, as you say, as a teenager, I was up at the fire shed a lot with Dad, on and off. And then when I was allowed to become a proper member, I joined up at the age of 15, and there was no doubt through that linkage with the brigade, I formed some very strong friendships, but I also gained a real sense of family, a real sense of belonging, a real sense of inclusion. And as I've said to people many a times in recent years, I truly believe a lot of basic life skills were developed and formed and improved through that role in the volunteer brigade, and everything from negotiation to argument to compromise, to teamwork, to leadership, negotiating, interacting with people, all focusing on trying to work out what was best for a local community and how to do things better and all those sorts of things, but also having a bit of fun. And as you say, Jim, as a young fella, I lived on the beach. I did everything from BMX racing. I did down on the beach, have a crack at surfing. We did a bit of stuff out in pit water in boats. And so always doing those sorts of things. And I remember some headlines in the local Manly Daily at the time, and there was a handful of us that were all school-age kids or university sort of kids, and there was a headline that read something like, you know, coming into this summer, when school holidays are on, the bush is where you'll find them, not the beach, or something like that. And it was an unusual message, because most of the young people gravitated towards the beaches, and why wouldn't you when you're living down that way? But we found, and I found, a real sense of belonging, a real sense of purpose, and an ability to achieve and have some fun when I was in the Volunteer Bushfire Brigade, back then the Duffy's Forest Bushfire Brigade.
Shane, thanks for sharing that. It's been an amazing story and journey at this stage, and we can't wait to come back. We're going to go to a little break, and then we're going to come back and find out more about you and someone by the name of Lisa. You probably know about her, and we're going to talk a little bit about her. You're on Alive 90.5 on Spotlight with Darren and Jim, and it's just an awesome morning.
Alive 90.5.
It's 22 minutes past 10, Alive 90.5 Spotlight with Jim and Darren.
Really delighted to have on the line this morning a person who I respect immensely, a person who gives so much to our community, just an incredible person. Shane Fitzsimmons, the Commissioner for Resilience New South Wales, an amazing person. Shane, let's walk through some things. You make reconciliation with your father, George. Tell us about that moment. Just the reflections of that, because that was a big decision and something that you wanted. And
Absolutely. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that was something that you wanted and you worked towards, and that would have been a very testing time of who you are and your dad and so on. And you share that story so beautifully.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And I think over the years, my relationship, waxed and waned a bit. And then I think it was at my 21st birthday when things became rather unpleasant. And Dad and I had a pretty big falling out, and I didn't talk to him for quite a while. It was a pretty serious falling out, to the point that I didn't invite him to my wedding or anything like that. And it was a few years after my wedding in 1997, actually. Lisa, my wife, was pregnant with our first daughter, and as it turns out, you know, sometimes there's these spooky coincidences.
Yes.
But Lisa talked me into. She said, "It's about time you tried to reconcile with your father. He deserves the right to know that he's going to become a grandfather." And as it turns out, our first daughter was born on Dad's 50th birthday, so they shared the same birthday, and it was a pretty big milestone for him. But we did reconnect, and you know, I was an adult by that. I was more of an adult by that stage, and so the relationship was different. But I'm forever grateful that I did reconnect and have those few years of connection. He was certainly in my eyes, a wonderful grandfather to Lauren. He would often call in and spend time there on his way to and from work and all that sort of thing. And we caught up a lot over those few years before we lost Dad.
And I want to talk about that, if I may, yeah. Shane. I mean, isn't it amazing, because you say in your books and wider readings that we often make better grandfathers than we do fathers, you know, in the sense, mm-hmm. as a generalisation, and you shared that with us. So we go from that stage, your father doesn't come to the wedding, and, you know, all of those things that you reflect and build within yourself and to share with us this morning is just absolutely amazing. But I want to take you to that moment. I think it was June the 8th, but it certainly was June.
Yes.
A major, major event. You were in a situation where someone had to tell you something. Walk through that.
So on the 8th of June, you're right, it was the 8th of June 2000. I remember very vividly the day. I was working at the Rural Fire Service. I was part of the state operations team where we'd keep track of fire activity and operational activity around the state on a 24-hour basis. And we started getting these media reports in that there'd been a serious injury and potential loss of life of firefighters. And we quickly checked all our points and we didn't have anything. And then very quickly we did some more analysis with our firefighting partner agencies. And it turned out that National Parks, Dad was working with National Parks at the time, but National Parks were doing some prescribed burns, some hazard reduction burning up in the Ku-ring-gai National Park there, up at Mount Ku-ring-gai, on the northern areas of Sydney. And the reports were that a crew had been overrun by fire. Well, I knew that if there was burning going on, my old man would be involved. And I remember trying to call his mobile over and over again, and I couldn't get any answers. And then we got the reports through that there were serious casualties, serious burn injuries, and people that had been reported as killed in that fire overrun. So we ended up heading out to the Hornsby district there, and I remember catching up with the National Parks manager, and I said, I need to know the names. He said, Shane, we're not in a position to release names at the moment. We're still trying to, you know, just clarify the details and get in contact with their designated next of kin, which is the normal thing to do, people to register their next of kin. You know, they're the processes for advice and what have you, respecting families. And in the end, I remember saying, you know, I know what's going on here. Just give me some details. And I'll never forget, he said to me, look, he said, I don't know how to say it, but I'm sorry, mate, but your dad's one of the people that's died on the mountain today. And then I was able to ring my stepmom and other members of the family. And, yeah, it's a day that will sit with me forever.
Shane, I can't begin to and to thank you for sharing with us. I feel really connected to you when you say those things. At that very point when they told you, what can you remember how you felt at that particular point?
I think I was in a moment of disbelief. You talk about when you get really difficult news, how your body processes it, and for me. Mm. I think what I struggled with was, no, there's no way my old man would die in a routine hazard reduction burn. He's been doing it for decades and decades.
Too smart.
And decades, you know, too smart, too experienced, et cetera, et cetera. And that was the general sentiment that ultimately came through from so many people that knew and had worked with Dad as a volunteer or as a salaried firefighter. And it's really difficult to process those sorts of things, but for me, you know, growing up in all my experiences of difficult times or times of crisis, I tend to get my head into an activity mode, action oriented. Things have got to be done. So I then focused on wanting to understand what had happened, who else was involved, and as it turns out, Dad was one of seven people in that crew that day, and he, along with two others of his colleagues, died on the mountain that day. Another fellow died about a month later from the injuries he'd sustained on that day. He died in hospital about a month later. And three others survived to this day with the extraordinary, you know, physical and emotional scars and memories from that event. So there were so many people directly impacted and affected by this extraordinary accident, but there were so many others that were indirectly impacted and affected by the tragedy, by the enormity of what had happened in what was otherwise a routine prescribed burn operation. So yeah, just being able to connect with and contact family, and then go and out to visit and see the accident scene and get a sense in my mind of where they were and what was going on and what was the weather, because trying to understand how and why to this day. What I wouldn't give, you know, just for 5 minutes to talk to my dad to find out what happened in those final moments, because even through the coronial inquest, we've never really been able to land those final moments, and some of the key people, one of the key persons that was there, was just not physically or emotionally able to give evidence. So, yeah, there's little things that will never be answered for me, but I think... that's not unusual for a lot of people when they lose loved ones in tragic circumstances.
Shane, it's Darren here. Thank you very much for sharing that. It's a gut-wrenching story, actually, with four people dead in June. You don't expect it that time of the year. How do you turn around and not just give it all away, not just leave the RFS? How did you turn around? What would your guiding influence? And you stayed around, and we all know... became commissioner, but what was that journey after that harrowing day?
Oh, Darren, I came very close to giving it all away, and I said to myself, and you know, I said, if this can happen to my old man, then what the hell am I in this game for? Why am I part of this? You know, for someone with all that experience to, you know, to succumb to a routine hazard reduction burn, something's horribly wrong, and I just can't be part of this anymore. I really struggled with that, but I didn't struggle with it for too long in terms of the idea of getting out. And as a matter of fact, people said to me, just take a break, take a rest, whatever you need, et cetera, et cetera. And I was able to then sit there and reflect and do a lot of contemplation. And I developed a stronger resolve to be part of the solutions going forward. And what I don't like more broadly in life is those that sit back on the sideline and have all these wonderful views and opinions about what people should do and shouldn't do, who've never been part of it, or they sit back in this armchair of pontification about, you know, what should be done and how it should be done, and they're so expert, but they're so removed. And I didn't want to be one of those. I didn't want to be one of those people removed and, you know, putting commentary in or shots in from afar. So the best thing to do in any circumstance, in any situation, is to be part of the problem understanding, the problem solving, and the solution generating. And my commitment was, you know, out of that day, we've got to continue to do all that we can with what we've got available to make sure we don't lose firefighters on the fire ground, whether that's prescribed burning operations or bushfire fighting operations. We've got to do all we can to invest in training and systems and programs and equipment and technology and all those sorts of things, building on lessons to make sure we get it as right as we possibly can for those operating in what is an inherently dangerous and volatile environment. And we've seen the worst of that, obviously, during the 1920 fire season.
And we're going to talk a little bit about that when we come back after a break. You're on Spotlight on 90.5 with Shane Fitzsimmons, the Commissioner for Resilience. An amazing story. And I'm going to give you a little break to think about Lisa, Shane, because we're going to come back and we're going to talk about your family, because we want to put some positiveness on what a marvellous person she has been in your life. You've said it many times, and your family. So we'll be back after a little break.
Thanks, Jim.
Alive 90.5.
It's 19 minutes to 11. Alive 90.5 Spotlight with Jim Darren.
Really delighted to have on the line Shane Fitzsimmons, the current Commissioner for Resilience New South Wales, telling his story and the great work that his people do to help protect us. And a really amazing story. Shane, someone comes into your life. I think you were only 20 or 21, very young. I was married similar age, but a very young age. And has been with you, stood beside you, helped you, and done so many things. Tell us about when you met Lisa, your wonderful wife.
Yeah, Jim, she is a wonderful person, and as a matter of fact, I met Lisa when I was a volunteer, still at school, still at high school, and her father became the new fire controller, the employee of council that managed local volunteers in the Warringah Shire back then, and I got to know her family, as her dad was in this new position, but also my dad was working for council at the time on what they called the bushfire mitigation crew or the prevention crew, doing a lot of fire trail work and things like that. So I got to know the family, and I became particularly close to Lisa's brothers, and one brother in particular, her brother Robbie, who was a bit older than her, but he was a disabled fellow. He had physical and mental disabilities, but he had a real strong affection and affinity with the bushfire brigade, and we were able to take him up to the brigade and let him participate in all the social activities and the quiet times of maintenance and that sort of thing. So it became a very regular thing that weeknights and weekends I would pick him up and take him up to the fire shed, and yeah, he was just a constant fixture in a lot of my time at the brigade. And through that, I got to meet Lisa and the rest of the family. And I remember very vividly in the early stages asking her out a few times, and she rejected me outright. but eventually she gave in and said yes. And then I was very fortunate as the years rolled on that we stayed together, and she accepted my proposal to get married. And she's been with me ever since, absolutely.
Well, Shane, she's a very intelligent person. There's no question about that, to accept your proposal. But on a serious note, what has she taught you? I mean, we think about our partners, but, you know, what has she taught you during very difficult times?
Well, she's taught me so much, Jim. And a little anecdote. I remember back in those early days, her dad was fire control and stuck at home all the time, no mobile phones, all those sorts of things. And I remember very vividly her saying to her mum and dad when we had an argument about something, I'm never getting involved in anyone that works in this bloody organisation because it just takes over your life and there's time, you know, demands on time all the time. We're never home, and if we want to go out, we can't go out because we've got to be at home for radios and emergency calls and all those sorts of things. And her mum and dad reminded her of that over and over again as the years rolled on, and particularly more recently. But Jim, I think her background in understanding the volunteer culture and what it means to be there for volunteers and support volunteers 24 hours a day has been a remarkable benefit in my ability to spend so much time over the years with the RFS, and also in those latter years as the commissioner. Lisa doesn't have a nasty bone in her body. She tries to find the good in everybody, and I think anyone that talks about her would talk about her willingness to offer support and friendship, you know, and care no matter the circumstances. But for me, you know, she's been a wonderful wife and an amazing mother to our two daughters. But she's also, through the very difficult times, and particularly, as I mentioned very publicly, during the unprecedented circumstances of the 2019-20 fire season, she was my rock. She was my go-to when I was emotionally broken on a number of occasions during the season. I would ring and I could barely say a word. I was so distressed. But they often say in those most important and necessary calls or those interactions, often so much is said without words. And for me, just being able to reach out and connect and know that I had that, you know, unconditional support. She worried enormously about me and my health and that sort of thing, as you would expect. But it's that ability to just have a sounding board, just to be able to reach out and vent, because when you are the commissioner of an organisation or the CEO of an organisation, it's a pretty lonely place at times, and you want to be strong and resilient for your people, but you know, there's no shame in being vulnerable and susceptible to issues as well. But the ability just to reach out independently and connect with someone, she's always been an amazing counsel, advice, guidance. And she keeps me grounded, Jim. Let's make no bones about that. When I walk in the door after any day at work, I'm in charge of nothing, and heaven help me if I try to be. The only thing I've got authority of at home is stacking the dishwasher, because I get frustrated with the way they do it. So I know my place very much when I get home, and that's been a really important thing for me, is to, you know, always be grounded and always just be, you know, a normal person, no matter what role or what challenge you're dealing with. And she's been able to do that for me, for sure.
Thanks for sharing that. Can I just say, on behalf of Darren and myself in particular, and Spotlight 90.5 FM, to you, Lisa, and to your girls, we just thank you very much for what you do. So often people thank you, and the song that we played before, The Wings Beneath, is about saying you and I and Darren get thrown in the spotlight, but you're right about that. Coming home, and there's a little saying that says, sometimes lovers can sit on a park bench and hold hands and never say a word and show each other how much they love each other.
Yeah, and that's so important, Jim. And look, I know through some really difficult times during that fire season, the minute I got, you know, particularly in the car on my own or just somewhere on my own, I was an emotional mess. Yeah. But I had to ring somebody, and invariably that would have been Lisa. It was Lisa.
Well, again, we just thank you, Lisa, publicly from our hearts, all of New South Wales and the families. Thank you so much. It is about you today, Shane, but we want to thank you. At the end of the day, we're all human. I want to take you. At age 44, you're tapped on the shoulder to become the youngest commissioner. I can't believe how quick our time goes, and there's so much we can talk about. Unbelievable story, and yet in the year 2019 and 20, in many ways, tips your thinking upside down. You have to take stronger leadership, and so many things happened during that time. And I want to walk through and allow you a couple of minutes to talk to us, because there was so much pain and heartache, and I remember seeing you on the TV. But to take us back to Jeff Keaton, to Andrew O'Dwyer and Samuel McPaul, you know, the things going through your mind, as you said, when you were told of that, you immediately went to see them. Walk us through that 1920 period of what your recollections were during that, an amazing time.
It was an unprecedented fire season for so many reasons. The longest, most protracted fire season we've ever seen. Some of the most intense and rapidly spreading fire that we've ever seen. It was breaking convention in terms of fire behaviour and fire spread. We were seeing some of the worst conditions at 2, 3 and 4 in the morning, where normally we would see that at 2, 3 and 4 in the afternoon. We had 160 to 200 days, consecutive days of continuous high-tempo operations. We saw tens of thousands of men and women giving of themselves day after day, night after night, week after week, month after month, with the whole purpose of just trying to save and protect as much as they possibly could. We saw a damage toll like we've never seen before in this state. 5.5 million hectares, just under 2,500 homes, and of course 26 lives lost, including 7 firefighters, 4 volunteers, and 3 air crew. The 4 volunteers, Jeff, Andrew, Sam and Cole, and then the 3 air crew, Ian, Rick and Paul. You know, there are dates and times etched in our memories that'll never be forgotten and change the lives of so many forever. But throughout all of that, I was fortunate to be part of a remarkable team of RFS members, but also all our firefighting colleagues in Fire and Rescue, National Parks, Forestry, all the police and emergency services. Every state and territory came to our aid. People from New Zealand, United States, Canada. We had remarkable government and political leadership and support, with no matter what was required to be done. So it was a very extraordinarily difficult time. And if I can say this without sounding insensitive or disrespectful in any way, I was also immensely proud of what people were doing and achieving during those darkest of times. And if ever I was looking for inspiration to turn up every day, I only had to see and hear what our people were doing relentlessly, and, you know, brave acts, remarkable acts that were saving life and saving property. And in the face of adversity, we saw the very best of people, humanity, of the Australian spirit, where people were just giving of themselves so selflessly to make a difference. And it reminded us that humanity triumphs over adversity, and we saw that over and over again during that fire season.
Shane, I have so many images and things, and so many people do. One image I want to share with you, because we're nearly running out of time and we want to find out about resilience, mm-hmm. was you bending down and putting that medal on that little boy. I'll never forget that. Very emotional.
No, absolutely, and I can remember very vividly that night, 19th of December, just before midnight, just got home from the State Operations Centre. I got a call from my deputy, early signals of a serious accident resulting in injuries or potential deaths. And as it turned out, that was the worst case scenario. As just as I started to get unchanged, getting ready to go to bed, I just got redressed and got straight out in the car and headed down to the accident scene where Jeff and Andrew were trapped, deceased in the vehicle, and their fellow crew had been taken to the ambulance to hospital. We then spent a few hours that night with fellow crew that were so traumatised by the event, and then of course after that we're able to go back to the homes, to the families of Jeff and of Andrew, and I got to meet the families, including those little toddlers, Jeff's little boy Harvey and Andrew's little girl Charlotte, their wives, their partners, their families, and then to be sharing then in their grief and then in their funeral and their ceremonies. The same with Sam. I was able to get a flight with a helicopter straight down near the Victorian border, go to the accident scene where Sam was trapped in that vehicle, spend time with the crews, and then back with his family, his lovely young wife and his mum, and then again memorial services and funerals that followed. As awful and as traumatic and as difficult as those times were, there is just no question about that. I will be forever grateful to the families for allowing us to come into their homes overnight on those nights, spend time with them, sharing some of that grief. It was difficult. It was traumatic, but I think there was something very sacred and very special about that time and being given permission to participate in the funeral services and memorial services to pay tribute and recognise these extraordinary individuals is something that will sit with me forever. And I think one of the most beautiful things about that image with young Harvey and putting the medal on his little uniform was that there was nothing planned about that, Jim. It just happened on the day. And I said to his mum, I said, do you think Harvey will let me? He said, yeah, you can have a go, Shane. He usually doesn't sit around. But he did it. But the image captured so poignantly the sacrifice and the enormity of what had happened in society with these individuals paying the ultimate price for the want of nothing in return but to make a difference to their community and save life and save property. And it's the ultimate sacrifice, and we'll be forever grateful to them and indeed the loss that their families and loved ones and their colleagues have suffered as a result of those tragic occurrences.
Shane, I'm going to be a bit cheeky.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about resilience. We've run out of time. Can we have you come back? Would you be so kind as to accept our invitation? Come back and tell the people of Western Sydney about resilience, what you're trying to do, what legacy you want to leave, how they can get involved and so on.
I'd love to, Jim. Love to.
Well, Shane, this has been one of the a moment in both Darren and my life that we will cherish and take with us. People like you, while there's plenty of them, are rare in the sense of your sincerity and your authenticity about giving your life, which you have, Lisa and your girls, to help the world in which we live. We can't thank you enough for sharing with us this story, which is so strong and just oozes with so much service. Thanks for being here with us on Spotlight on 90.5 FM. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you share your story with us. You truly are an amazing Australian.
Now, thanks, Jim. You're very kind, and I'll certainly pass on your appreciation to Lisa and the girls as well. It's very kind of you. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Have a great morning. Thank you.